Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. Well, you know, recently I read an online article relating to the ongoing revelations about famous men exposed as having sexually harassed or abused women, and in particular how people's perceptions of the way they look changes once that information is out there, and how well-liked men such as, for example, Matt Lauer, who always looked warm and likable and attractive, suddenly start to look the opposite to many people, even though their actual appearance doesn't change, at least immediately, right? So this is an example of how emotions or attitudes can alter our perceptions. And it's something I've always noticed. And in college, I had a T-shirt made, for example, that said, "I'll see it when I believe it," you know, which is kind of the flip of the usual cliche or whatever. And so my guest today is an expert on that phenomenon. Dr. Ronald Riggio is a psychology professor at Claremont McKenna College in California. He specializes in leadership and organizational psychology, including nonverbal communication. I ran across him when he was being quoted in the article I mentioned earlier. Dr. Riggio is joining us from California. Welcome, Dr. Riggio.
Thanks, Court. Great to be with you.
And I'm going to call you Ron from here on out, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
So here's one of your quotes from that article. It's, "We construct images of people and associate those images with qualities that we believe the individual possesses. So Lauer's appearance, when people thought he was wholesome, gracious, and kind, was interpreted to be consistent with those qualities. He appears innocent, his smile boyish and endearing. Now, after the revelations, we see that smile as a smirk," Riggio explains. "The same smile is interpreted differently based on our constructed image of him." So can you elaborate on that whole concept?
Well, that's a core part of person perception. So we have ideas, attitudes, expectations about people, based on their behavior, based on our interactions with them, or in the case of celebrities, based on what we see or what we know about them. We construct a social image of that person. If you think about it in sort of the political sphere, if it's someone who shares our political beliefs, we're automatically inclined to have a sort of a positive expectations and positive image of them. If they're counter our political views, then right away we're going to be negative. And some of our research, we actually talk about this idea of is this person a hero or a villain? Like, or, you know, is this person likable or dislikable? And then that colors the rest of our perception of the person.
Yeah, and I think that changes over time, too. I mean, probably people have had the experience of, let's say, a girl having a boyfriend, and then they break up, and suddenly that boyfriend doesn't look as good-looking and handsome as he did. He suddenly looks like a jerk or something. And, you know, and on the same page as the article I read that I mentioned a minute ago, there was a sidebar. Another example of it, Casey Anthony's life, and she's the Florida woman who was acquitted of killing her daughter a few years back. Casey Anthony's life, as her notoriety fades, guys are paying attention to her again and think she's hot. You know, for a long time she was viewed as the most hated woman in America, and I suspect guys didn't think she was hot. But, you know, so those things fluctuate as memories fade and that kind of thing. It's kind of malleable, right?
That's right. They change over time.
So
it's interesting you brought that up because O.J. Simpson was, you know, just recently released from prison, and women were starting to find him attractive, and they'd sort of forgotten, you know, what was going on.
Even though he was so many years older, too, yeah. But, I mean, you know, celebrity is always, you know, that flame in the moths are attracted. But, you know, along that same line, Bill Cosby, for example. I mean, there are a lot of, you know, kind of admired men, even idolized men whose images have changed so much. Charlie Rose recently. I mean, who would have thought, right? And then, you know, somebody like Bill Clinton. I don't know. He's kind of the Teflon man, right? His image hasn't changed that much, but I think it has changed, right? But then people like Garrison Keillor. I mean, George Bush Sr. I mean, I don't know if their image changes really with these accusations, but it is startling, and I think it sort of destabilizes your view of the world, you know, of the reliability of your images of people. You know, it's a whole other topic, I guess. But do you find that feeling of having a flaw in your view of people has been eroded? You know, that people are less able and willing to develop kind of strong positive or negative images about people for fear that they might be undermined? Or is that something that hadn't been researched much yet?
Well, I think it's an ongoing process. So I think we have images of people, we find out more information about them, and that changes our image. And if we find out positive information about them, then our image and our perception of them becomes more positive. If something negative happens, and particularly in these extreme cases like what we're seeing now, then all of a sudden it can shift from a positive image to a negative image. And that idea of Matt Lauer looking boyish and positive and wholesome, and now he looks evil, you know, that's part of that this sort of huge piece of information that drastically changes our perception from, you know, he was kind of heroic and positive to now he's negative and villainous.
You know, and again, you mentioned O.J. Simpson, you know, who I think everybody viewed as just a great positive role model, especially for African-American people and young men. And when that happened, it's sort of like a little corner of your world crashed down, you know, so that kind of thing occurs with these collapses of image, right? But maybe another factor is that the media start selectively picking pictures of those people that are different than the ones they would have used before. Do you think that happens?
I think that's true. In the Yahoo article, the picture of Matt Lauer was one where he has sort of an interesting smile, almost like a Mona Lisa smile, and you can interpret that as either a sort of positive. I think that's where I came up with the term boyish, because it looked like that, but in another way, it looked like a smirk.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's exactly what happened. And in fact, I noticed that picture in a lot of other news reports, too.
Yeah, so that happens with political figures who suddenly fall out of favor. They'll find pictures that suddenly make them look nefarious in some way, or corrupt somehow, or something, or less trustworthy. So it's, I think the media add to that psychological effect by giving you visual cues and effects that kind of multiply it or whatever, accentuate it. Well, you're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Dr. Ron Riggio, who's a professor of psychology at Claremont McKenna College in California, from where he's joining us today. One of your premises is the idea of how power affects these things. So let's talk about power in this connection. I mean, I guess old, ugly, poor, and powerless men don't get to brag about grabbing women by their private parts and getting away with it. They get slapped or beaten up and probably arrested for it, but the point of this recent landslide of accusations is that men, and sometimes women, in positions of power do get away with that kind of thing. And obviously the casting couch is nothing new, whether it's in Hollywood or politics or business or athletics. So, you know, what's the connection of power to this phenomenon?
Yeah, well, a lot of this is about power, right? It's about the dynamics of power. So in many instances, particularly in these instances where it's definitely a one way, you know, the perpetrator, in almost all the cases that we're seeing now, the man, you know, is the high power individual. And really, it in many instances is not so much about sex per se as it is about sort of the power dynamics that I'm in control. So, you know, control, power, subjugation, that's what's driving a lot of this.
I noticed sometime back that Sheryl Sandberg, who's the chief operating officer of Facebook, has talked about personally being convinced that power, from her experience, and not really sexuality, as you just said, is the driving force behind this kind of predation. Because when she was lower on the corporate totem pole, more men would hit on her and treat her in, sexually disrespectful ways. Nothing really heavy like some of these things that we're hearing about lately, But as she rose up, that happened less and less because the men below her in stature and power in the corporation weren't doing that, and there were fewer men above her. And I think they probably, in many cases, tended to be more civilized people. But she said she was personally convinced that absolutely power has a lot to do with it. But I wouldn't discount the idea that just sex alone has to do with it. I mean, it has to... With men in particular, there's some degree of it being ego fuel for people who really need to have a big ego to function in the world that they're in, whether it's entertainment or business or politics. To some extent, a lot of sex can pump that up and keep you on in addition to the power thing. I think they may interact. I mean, what do you think about that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, definitely there's the sex drive is going on, right? And but it really, the fact that it's these powerful men hitting on less powerful women. So in Matt Lauer's case, another woman came out and mentioned that she had a consensual relationship. I think she started out as an intern at NBC or something. And she mentioned it was a consensual relationship, but she talked about the power dynamics. In other words, he was still controlling the situation. he was demanding, you know, sort of sex at sort of in his office or in a waiting room or something like that. So she actually mentioned the power dynamics, that had I been a more powerful person, it may not have, you know, taken that sort of course. It might have been more of a sort of equal, consensual relationship, right?
Yeah, what you think of as an adult affair, really, where, as you say, the circumstances are equal and not so demanding on one side. You know, but I think kind of the flip side of this thing, and where it gets murky and a little bit politically incorrect to talk about, because it's not something that you're gonna have a big discussion about on CNN or Fox News or whatever, is that I think it's obvious to most people that powerful men, by and large, this is a thing in one gender direction rather than another, I think, powerful men tend to be attractive in and of itself to women often. Someone who, you know, as I said earlier, somebody who's old and ugly and rich looks a lot different to many women than a guy who's merely old and ugly. And,
yeah.
So there's that phenomenon that kind of draws women into a situation often where they then can be manipulated and abused in a way that is sort of consensual, but maybe changes and becomes less consensual, but then they're trapped. I mean, there's a lot of dynamic to this stuff socially and psychologically, right?
Yeah, no, there's a long history of research on attraction. And now I'm being very general here, but essentially men are attracted. The first thing they're sort of seeing is, you know, attractive women. So attractiveness is a big deal. With women, attractiveness is important, but what also is important is this idea of sort of power and, you know, what are the possibilities with this person? And so money then is attractive to women. And I'm talking generally here, but so you're right. I mean, that there is this women being sort of attracted to the power part of it. But when you think about it in the work situation, it's really like, how can this person help my career? That's often what's going on. And I think if you look at all of these cases, or many of these cases, the Bill Cosby, the Matt Lauer, the women were looking for sort of mentoring. And so they were coming at it from that direction. And if you sort of flip it over and look at the men, they were looking at it, here's a lower power person. Yes, I can offer assistance and mentoring, but in exchange, then I expect sexual favors, right? The women aren't coming into it saying, oh, they're looking for mentoring, and they're not looking for the sexual part, right?
Yeah, from the man's standpoint, there are strings attached, and the woman doesn't really realize that. And you said earlier that, you know, women are attracted to money, and of course, we both know, and everyone knows, that men are attracted to money, too. But I think the situation here we're talking about is the way our society's always been constructed and is breaking down and being a little less constructed this way now, is that the men are the ones who have the money. So, you know, the women who are young and struggling are attracted to the lifestyle that can bring in ways that it's not often the case that men would be attracted to an older woman with money, although sometimes that's true, too. Now, here's another, you know, as long as we're stumbling around in this politically incorrect arena here, I tend to think that women, we're getting back to this perceptual shifting thing that we talked about earlier, I tend to think that women are more prone to that perceptual shifting thing, emotionally speaking, than men are. And you alluded to it, too. I mean, I think, for example, men will generally judge a woman's attractiveness pretty consistently within, I would guess, a point or two on the crude 1 to 10 scale, no matter what they might think about the woman's personality. But I've always noticed, and I don't know if you notice this or not, but that most women, or not all certainly, but most women will assess a woman's attractiveness based on how they feel about that woman. So if they like the woman, they think she's beautiful. And if they don't like her, they think she's unattractive or ugly. Whereas men see it more objectively and can keep those perceptions separate. Is that something that's been shown in the past?
You know, that's interesting. I mean, I think what's happening is men are sort of thinking with their hormones. I mean, I think what's happening is men are not delving deeply into it, and so they're attracted, you know, to the physical appearance of the woman. I think women are coming at it, and they're saying they're judging the physical appearance, but from a different perspective. They're looking at it more as a sort of a, you know, heterosexual women, they're looking at it as competition, or they're, you know, commenting on the style. I mean, they're seeing things that the men aren't really seeing. And, you know, and I think the women are doing a sort of a deeper analysis, and it's partly because they're not just, you know, they've got multiple motives. The men may only have, you know, sort of one motive.
Yeah, I agree with you. And maybe another way to say it is I read somewhere years ago that men see other people with their eyes and women tend to see them more with their hearts, or maybe a mixture, as you were just saying, of their eyes and their hearts and other things. And so it's kind of a multidimensional assessment of that person. And whereas men will look at a woman, for example, pretty two-dimensionally often, you know, at least at first, right? And so that seems, that's that kind of thing that I read seems true to me, you know, and it kind of goes along with what we're saying here. But what do you think about that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's true. I mean, the other thing, too, is, you know, what's the man's intention about the relationship? And so they're looking, you know, looking first at sort of the sexual relationship or whatever. The woman is looking at this is a possible, you know, friend, colleague. What do I think about this other woman? And so, again, it's that it's sort of different motives and, you know, different potential relationship goals. And so it leads to a kind of a richer perception on the women's part, much less so on the man's part. And if we tie that back to the power thing, you know, men are looking at it, these powerful men are looking at this as like a conquest, right? And so there isn't, in many of these instances, any concern for the long-term relationship. And we sort of see this. I mean, these men aren't looking for a spouse, and particularly if we use, you know, Matt Lauer's case or Bill Cosby's case or whatever, they're both married, right? Mm. And so they were looking at it as sort of serial conquest to puff up their ego.
I mean, here again, we get into, we're floundering around in all this stuff here, but I think that men who are very successful with women become somehow more attractive to other women. I've seen it myself many times, and maybe a lot of our listeners have, but women will often develop a relationship with a man like that, a player, let's call him, and say, okay, well, I can change him. And that's a way of fooling yourself, because the players only love you when they're playing, as the song went, right? So they're not going to be, they're not looking for a spouse, as you say. They're looking for the next sexual conquest or whatever it might be, especially young sexually active men, right? But when we get into the older men, this power thing begins to be more a phenomenon with it, I think. So, well, you're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking again with Dr. Ron Riggio, who's a professor of leadership and organizational psychology at Claremont McKenna College in California. And we started off talking more about a thing that I kind of call perceptual shifting, but how your attitudes and emotions affect the way that people appear to you. You know, we've been talking so much about power. So if you agree that men are more prone to the abuse of power and therefore of other people than women are, why do you think that is? I mean, is it testosterone? Is it just biology? Or what goes into play there?
Well, you know, a part of it is biology. So testosterone is associated with power. There's some recent research evidence that I think is very interesting, and it looks at, you know, experiments where people can engage in sort of unethical behavior, and they found, you know, two relationships. One is that men were more prone to engage in this unethical behavior than women. But going along with that, higher testosterone levels were related to more ethical violations, too. And so there is some of that, the testosterone and the sort of dominance hierarchy. A lot of it, though, is social. So we have what we call social dominance hierarchies, too, right? The idea that, you know, men over women, rich over poor, white people over people of color. That's a very strong sort of social dominance order. And so that's playing a big part. You know, and to kind of flip it around a little bit, you know, powerful women, if you look at, you know, and so powerful women that would be kind of a obvious example, this would be the sort of divas, the actresses in Hollywood or whatever that are in powerful positions, and then sort of go down a similar kind of path of, you know, sort of collecting men as conquests. And the dynamic is really about the power. It's not so much about gender, but it, you know, I'm the powerful one. The men are attracted to me. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going, you know, after the conquest too. And I think like Lindsay Lohan, that was a big issue as she became a star. So I think it happens too. It's just rarer because of the fact that men tend to be in the high power positions.
Yeah, and it is, you know, it's a parallel thing where those women that you're describing, particularly in entertainment, the men they get involved with are a lot younger, by and large, you know, 20 years younger. Yeah. And so it may be that those younger men are looking for career advancement through that, too. You know, so it's flipping that same dynamic over to the other side. My guess is it's more prevalent in entertainment than it is in business or politics, maybe because there are just far fewer powerful women in business and politics than there are in entertainment, too, you know.
Yeah, I think that's true.
I remember kind of along these lines, shortly after being catapulted in from a Harvard professor to national security advisor in a very short period of time to President Nixon, Henry Kissinger said, "Power is the greatest aphrodisiac," and because this was like suddenly a revelation to him, I suspect that personally he suddenly felt like, whoa, I feel different, and women act differently toward me, and my life that way has changed suddenly because of my position, right? So he kind of crystallized what we're saying.
Well, and that relates to why, you know, so one of the things that people are wondering with all of this, you know, with all these disclosures about, you know, about the behavior of these men who were formerly admired and all of that, is like, what, you know, what's the dynamic of this? What's going on? And I think you've sort of, you know, gotten to that with this idea of the aphrodisiac. So powerful men who are put into the public eye, you know, in the media or in politics or whatever, then suddenly women are attracted to them. But what happens then is this sort of crossing the line of, you know, going beyond sort of just mutual consensual sex and forcing themselves on women. And you sort of ask the question, well, what's going on there? And a lot of that is that with power comes this idea of that I can do these things. Mm. I you know, because I'm powerful, the sort of social rules that govern other people don't apply to me. And there's some good evidence of this, that what happens is, and a philosopher colleague of mine calls it exception making, that these powerful people see themselves as exceptions. So I can do this. It's okay for me to do this. And part of that is the way that power sort of creates this sort of big ego perception.
Yeah, I mean, I forget who it was, and it's probably not even relevant to start talking specific names, but it, you know, one of these people who was brought down recently by these allegations said that, and the woman corroborated, it was like 40 years later, it was an actor, said, you know, what are you upset about? This comes with the territory. I deserve this, and you sign on for it, basically, by working in this industry under someone like me. And he said that very explicitly. I mean, it's like it was almost written into his unwritten contract, you know? I get to do this. Why are you objecting?
Yeah, I'm powerful. I'm entitled to this. This is okay.
Just as another example along that line, in the Access Hollywood tape, the idea of, well, if you're a celebrity, you can get away with this. They'll let you do it.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of other, you know, complexities going on. I mean, you often see that some of these people, and particularly the ones that aren't, you know, like particularly attractive, so you're thinking without the money and the power, they wouldn't, you know, have all that much, you know, appeal to some women. And, you know, I mean, I don't, not to single out, but Harvey Weinstein doesn't sort of come across as a dashing, you know,
right,
sort of a handsome character. But, you know, I think what happens too is those individuals, maybe early on, there wasn't much attraction from, or much attention from women. Mm. And so now that I have the power, now I can do these things that I couldn't do before. And so I think that kind of fuels things too. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of complexity.
Yeah, and viewing women as just commodities. I can buy a bunch of houses and yachts, and I can also buy women. I can get them.
Yeah, and that's obviously the case. I mean, that's what's really terrible about this, because what's happening is these very, very powerful men are preying on women who are trying to sort of start their careers, and they're really victims. I mean, and it's the powerful preying on the powerless, and we have to really realize how important that is.
You know, I see a connection to this, and getting back to the perceptual shifting concept, you know, that your attitudes and emotions affect the way you see things. I think it's the basis of much of propaganda. I mean, you know, like brainwashing, for example. In Vietnam, in particular, I remember the idea that the war was seen as a struggle for the hearts and minds of the Vietnamese, and we clearly failed to get the first, the hearts, and so we never got the second, and I don't know if we ever would have, but anyway, in a in a totalitarian country like Nazi Germany or North Korea today, control of the media combined with the fear of punishment for even, I guess, thinking subversive thoughts makes people see the glorious leader as godlike and beyond reproach. So is there some kind of culture-wide or society-wide shifting of views that you can see going on like that? We just have a few minutes left here.
Well, I think some of that is involved in these situations. So initially, think about when the first accusations came out against Bill Cosby or any of these powerful individuals, is people are saying, no, not this person, because they have this positive image of them. And they start to defend them and say, oh, can't. And then that just makes it worse for the poor victims, right? Yeah. You know, because they're just trying to disclose what's going on, and now all of a sudden they're vilified, and so it just magnifies that.
Well, all 10 of these women are lying, and, well, gosh, maybe all 50 of these women are lying, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
At a certain point, you just shut up, I suppose. So, you know, finally then, I guess we've got maybe 3 or 4 minutes here, but I'd like to connect this whole thing we're talking about, and I think it's maybe a stretch, but you tell me, with the growing divisiveness or divisiveness, however you want to say it, we see in the country, especially in politics, but in our culture generally, and kind of the polarization of liberals and conservatives, it's becoming extreme, and it's fueled by the internet and by mass media, and it leads to a demonization of the other, you know, kind of turning the people who don't agree with you into black and white, two-dimensional evil stereotypes. So do you see it that way, that it's kind of connected to this perceptual shifting thing?
You know, that is a huge factor. I mean, we call that in-group, out-group bias, we-they bias, whatever. You know, we're the good guys, they're the bad guys. And it's a very, very powerful psychological process. I mean, it's almost sort of hardwired into us. If you think, I mean, it's the basis for wars. It's the basis for discrimination and prejudice. Mm-hmm. It's a huge effect. And one of the issues, if we talk about, you know, us becoming more civilized human beings, is, you know, what that civilization means is overcoming that tendency, because it's all too easy to vilify other people. You know, I just read something about if you disagree with someone, have the disagreement face-to-face. Don't have it over the internet, right? Don't have it electronically, because it's too easy to exacerbate that process, right? Make that process worse. Say something really damaging. But there's evidence that doing it face-to-face has a sort of a calming effect on it. And if you kind of keep your emotions in check, it's very easy to say horrible things in an email or on Twitter or something like that, right?
I totally agree with you, but I think it's easier said than done, you know, because we live in a world that's connected so much that way. And, yeah, I mean, it's part of why things are less civil than they were 30, 40 years ago, I suspect. But, you know, I guess we're at the end of the show here, Ron, and this is something we could go on talking about, certainly. But I guess we're going to have to leave it there, and I think we've said enough to kind of elucidate this idea a little bit anyway. I want to thank you so much for being on with us on American Variety.
Well, thank you for having me, Court. It's great.
Thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.